Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. This is a weekly program, as I hope most of you know, devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our hopes for the future, all the things that make up the quality of our lives in terms of the money we earn, the money we spend, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I teach these days at the New School University here in New York City, where the program originates. I also want to direct your attention, and I will do that again in the program later when we have our guest interview, to the two websites we maintain where you can find out a great deal more about the topics discussed in this program. The first one is rdwolf.com with two F's, Wolf with two F's, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. Not only do they contain classes, lectures, audio, tapes, indeed an archive of every one of these programs, but both websites also offer you two other things. One, a way to communicate with us, what you like and don't like, questions you'd like us to answer. In the second 15 minutes of this program, I will be answering some of those selected questions. And likewise, the two websites allow you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and thereby keep an even closer contact with the ongoing economic realities of our lives. I'll come back to that sort of announcement a little bit later, but I want to jump into updates, and I want to start with an unusual one. I want to bring to your attention a group of people based in California who run annual visits to Mondragon, Spain. As you know, Mondragon is one of the outstanding examples of worker cooperatives, enterprises, and they now have about 100,000 workers, enterprises that are owned and operated collectively and democratically by all the workers in them who don't have separate owners, who do not have a board of directors that they have to deal with but do not control. Mondragon is, in a way, the most successful of these projects, 50 years plus counting old. And here is an opportunity, if anyone is interested, to go on a trip. This one will be from May 10th to May 16th of 2015. You will be taken on tours by the Mondragon people and shown literally every aspect of their work. There are two full scholarships, otherwise there are prices to pay. And I want to leave you with a website, if you're interested, in visiting this ongoing reality of workers' self-directed enterprises, www.praxispeace.org, P-R-A-X-I-S, Praxispeace, as in War and Peace, .org. Take a look at their website, and if you're interested, here's a way to become acquainted and let the rest of the people that you know learn about the most ambitious program in worker co-ops existing in the world today. Over the last week, one of the big news stories had to do with the Democratic Party here in the United States. It came out in a way it hadn't before for quite a while with a progressive economic proposal. It is a little bit strange, the timing, since it comes immediately after the Democrats have lost any ability to get such a proposal through either House of Congress, since they are now the minority party in both of the Houses of Congress. What they put forward, however, is clearly designed to show the kind of thing they want to be known for, even if they can't get it, and even if they were silent about it during the time when they might have gotten it. They call it, and the press calls it, the Robin Hood tax. We've talked about it before, but I want to go over it again so it is clear in everyone's mind. Why the Robin Hood tax? Well, because it claims to take from the rich and give to the poor. The real technical name for this is called the financial transactions tax, and it is mostly associated with a Nobel Prize-winning economist here in the United States named James Tobin. And for reasons of disclosure, I should explain that Mr. Tobin was my teacher of economics at Yale University, and I learned about the tax from him initially. Here's the idea. When we go to the store and buy a shirt or a toaster or a coffee machine, we know that we typically pay the price of the item and then a sales tax, a portion of money that goes to the government that's a percentage of the price of the article we buy. And the idea of the financial transactions tax is this. If the average person has to pay a sales tax every time he or she makes a purchase of a commodity, why shouldn't the same apply to the people who buy and sell stocks and bonds and derivatives and securities of all different kinds? In other words, they should have a sales tax too. The sales tax across the United States for consumer goods ranges from 3.5% to 4% on the one end, all the way up to 8.5% to 9%, depending on where you live and how high the sales tax is. The Democrats proposed a financial transactions tax at the rate not of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9%, but at 0.1%. In other words, tiny. The original proposal of Professor Tobin was for 0.5%. And the idea is this would tax the bankers, the insurance companies, the stockbrokers, the people who do the bulk of the buying and selling of financial instruments. And it would take from these folks who are the richest amongst us, because they're the ones who have these things and they're the ones who trade in these things, it would take from them a significant amount of money, the hope is, and use it for the general well-being. That's where it gets that name, Robin Hood, because it taxes from the upper income. Of course, it shouldn't be called Robin Hood because they should have been paying a reasonable sales tax all along. And indeed, in American history, at various times, we've had one. But in the go-go neoliberal period of the last 20, 30 years, it was pushed out of existence because, like everything else, the rich wanted to become richer, and getting rid of this tax, and I'll be telling you more about this sort of story, was just a bump along the road. So here come the Democrats, with no chance of getting it passed, announcing that they are interested in a Robin Hood tax, a tax on financial transactions. In Europe, they're discussing it as well. It's a bit further along in Europe as an idea because the Europeans are organized so that their trade unions and their left-wing political parties have been pushing in this era of mass anger at bankers and other manipulators of securities for having brought us the crisis, for having gotten the bailouts that the governments were ready to give. There's a feeling they could at least pay some taxes of the sort they should have been all along. But both in Europe and here in the United States, the chances actually now look quite slim for this being passed. And I thought you'd enjoy the rationale. The Europeans say we shouldn't do that because if we do, then these transactions that we would like to tax won't happen in Europe anymore. People will, with the aid of a computer, make those transactions in the United States to escape a tax if we levy one here in Europe. And at the same time, the Americans opposed to it are saying, gee, we shouldn't do that here in the United States because if we do, the transactions will move to Europe. So very conveniently, the Europeans don't do it for fear that the Americans might not, and the Americans don't do it for fear that the Europeans might not, with the end result that neither one does, and the financial industry has escaped its share of taxation yet one more time. Next update. Small statistic, but one that tells a big story. The Reuters news agency reported on January 12th the remarkable statistic, at least I thought so, that airline traffic in the United States has dropped several percentage points in the last year, whereas bus travel has gone up 5 or 6%. That's right. In the United States, people are taking airplanes less often and riding on buses more often. Now, the explanation is not far to seek. Air traffic, is expensive relative to bus traffic, and so that's a big part of the story. The airlines themselves have been making it more and more unpleasant as they build in a first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth class of travel. Used to be that an airplane had first class and economy. Then it had first class, business, and economy. Now it has economy, economy plus, economy extra, business one, business two. The point being, to make it more of a class system, to make travel in the air something which, if you don't have the money, you get squeezed like a sardine in the back of the airplane, whereas if you do have money, you get a first-rate meal and lots of service in the front of the airplane. Those of you who've taken airplanes recently know exactly what I'm saying, and people are turned off of this experience. So we have yet another sign, and here's the big lesson, of a kind of systematic down-leveling of the standard of living of most Americans. You're not going on an airplane. If you're going to go on an airplane, we're going to squeeze you into a sardine-sized seat and give you a collection of very old peanuts and a Coke to drink, and that's it. You're not going to get much service. You're not going to get many amenities. You're going to get what we think you're worth. And that is not much. And for those of you that can't even afford to be a sardine in the airplane, well, then there's the bus, isn't there? And you can sit on the bus and make do with that. It's the lowering of the standard of living that is part of what every one of these programs has to report on, because it's an overwhelming phenomena of the turn of capitalism away from the places it was originated, away from Western Europe, away from North America, away from Japan, to focus its growth, its expansion, and its future on Asia, Latin America, Africa, Eastern Europe, the places where wages are low and profits can be higher than they are in the old centers where deals had to be worked out with the workers over the years. So as capitalism moves its focus away from Western Europe, North America, and Japan, the standard of living of those workers in 100 little ways is reduced. And the problem is tense, and the problem is difficult. Indeed, much of the rest of this program today will teach us about the various places and ways this ratcheting down of the working class in the areas where capitalism began is the project of our time. Next update. Over the last week, we had a job market report, as we do at this time of month. Every month here in the United States, the government of the United States reported. And the great fanfare that got all the headlines buzzing was the reduction of our unemployment rate in the United States, the official rate, from 5.8% to 5.6%. And this was presented in most media coverage as a sign of quote-unquote recovery, a sign of quote-unquote the recovery of our economy and the good condition of the United States, which is then compared with great gusto to the poor conditions, relatively, in Europe, the slowing down of economic growth in China, and so on. I've talked about this before. I'm not going to go into why this is a misrepresentation of what's going on. I just want to focus on the labor market, because that's what this is about. Let's review where we then are with a 5.6% official unemployment rate in the United States. Over 8 million people are what we're talking about with 5.6%. So 8 million people are looking for work and not finding it. In addition, the government announced in smaller print that lots of the media didn't pay much attention to, that there are 7 additional million on top of the 8 million that are unemployed. There are 7 million who have part-time jobs that they don't want. They want full-time jobs but can't find them. Okay, we've got 8 million people without work at all looking, and 7 million people that are forced into part-time work. Now we have another 6 million that are quote-unquote discouraged workers. That is people who have stopped looking because they're so discouraged about the jobs they can't find. Well, let's add it up. 8 million unemployed, 7 million part-time who don't want to be, and 6 million discouraged. We're talking 21, 22 million people in the United States who are not earning anything like a regular, decent income. In fact, most of them are not earning any income at all. What is that about, and what does it mean? First, it means those people are using up any savings that they accumulated. It means those people are now more and more relying, as the savings dry up, on their friends, their relatives, their neighbors for help, meaning that the burden they represent is a burden being spread to tens of millions of other people in a very tangible way. That is, the social suffering caused by this level of unemployment is enormous in our society. The number 5.8 reduced to 5.6 makes it sound small and being solved, but it isn't. Much of the reason the unemployment rate has declined in recent years is not because we've solved the problem, but because those people have quit looking. And when they quit looking, the unemployment rate goes down because they've stopped looking, not because we have solved our unemployment problem. And finally, the notion of recovery, please. 22 million Americans have not been working. More if you look at the last 3 or 4 years when it was higher. We've lost forever the output they could have helped produce. The Federal Reserve tells us that 20% of the tools, equipment, raw materials, machines, office space, factory space, 20% in this country is sitting idle, gathering rust and dust. Those 22 million people could have worked with all those machines. They could have worked on all those raw materials instead of just losing them. We then would have had these 22 people adding to the total wealth of our society trillions of dollars that would have been available to rebuild our cities, to deal with our poverty program, to overcome homelessness, you name it. We failed as an economic system to do that. Capitalism in the United States couldn't find work for these people. We lost all that production. That's the reality. And that's a reality that's disguised by announcements about unemployment falling from 5.8 to 5.6%. Okay, let me turn from our updates to the second part of our program, and that's a part in which I respond to your questions. And again, I want to remind you that you can send us these questions through our two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. We get many more questions than we can possibly answer on the air, but I want to assure you we read every one and use it to design the program. Who we bring as a guest, as I will introduce today's guest in a few minutes, what we structure the program around, what topics we focus on. These are things we decide in large measure because you take the time and trouble, which we appreciate, to let us know what you would like us to do. The first question came in and it was sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I liked it. And the question went like this. Is it at least the case, this questioner said, that the people who run the big banks know about the scam they've pulled off on us? That they brought us a crisis by their lending to people who couldn't pay it back? They're supposed to know how to lend. By speculating in exotic financial instruments without knowing quite what they were getting into, and then snatching the bulk of the bailout funds for themselves. Do they kind of know the scam? And I think the answer to this interesting, if tongue-in-cheek question, is no, I don't think they do. Or maybe put a different way, they're so deep into it that, like you typically have, when you keep telling the same fake story often enough, the person who really ends up believing it the most is the one who tells the story, not necessarily the ones to whom the story is told. And so what caught my eye was the headline on January 15th in many American newspapers about an interview given by Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, who, and I want to read this to you so I don't misquote Mr. Dimon, who was asked about how he feels about regulation of his bank and of banking in general in America that's coming down from Washington. And here is his complaint. He's not happy about regulation. He thinks it's excessive. He's particularly angry that regulators, not only from the federal government, but from the state of New York and from a variety of jurisdictions are bothering the bank about what it's done that they feel is either illegal or unethical. So now, Jamie Dimon's words, quote, "In the old days, you dealt with one regulator when you had an issue. Now it's five or six." And he's speaking here to the media, and here comes the best part, quote, "You should all ask this question about how American that is, how fair that is." Yes, you heard right. Jamie Dimon thinks that the government is unfair in its regulation of the banking industry. This is the industry whose indiscriminate speculations, whose lending without the kind of supervision or checking that they ought to have done, brought us this crisis. Jamie Dimon and the other big bankers besides J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, they have all been paying billions of dollars in fines over the last 3 years for illegal money laundering, for manipulating the LIBOR interest rate in London. They are currently on the hook, and J.P. Morgan leading the pack, billions that they're going to have to pay for having manipulated the foreign currency markets. They've been caught doing literally every conceivable either illegal or unethical act that you could imagine. And they think it's unfair, after having admitted to much of that, that they be regulated. It is indeed un-American. Well, you got to take your hand off for the sheer nerve of the folks. So the answer to your question is, do they understand? My answer is, I don't think so. I think they are lost in a world in which anything they do is good, and anything that hampers them is bad and downright un-American. The next question I want to respond to was sent to me by several of you over the last month or two. It has to do with an explanation of the estate tax in the United States. So I want to give you a short overview to tell you a little bit about it. What is an estate tax? Very simple. It says that when you die, you have property. Everybody does. Some of us only have some underwear and some shoes and maybe a loaf of bread. Others of us have a nice portfolio of stocks and bonds, or a house, or a car, or some combination of all of those. And an estate tax says that when you pass whatever property you have to whoever you've given it to, typically your family, your surviving spouse, your children, and so on, the government comes in and takes a portion of that as a tax on your estate, on what you leave to the next generation. Okay, what's the idea behind this? Very simple, very basic democratic idea, namely that a fair society has everybody starting on a level playing field. The child born to a poor family and the child born to a wealthy family, neither of those two children had anything to do with deciding who, where, how they were born, and they should have an equal chance to find their own skills, to find their own jobs, to make their contribution to the larger society. And one of them shouldn't have a ton of money to help them in life, because that would be unfair to the child who, through no fault of his or her own, was born into a family of modest means. So an estate tax was always designed to equalize the playing field, to give every young person a roughly equal chance. So you take away from those who have so that they are roughly the same as those who don't have, or at least don't have so much. Very old idea. Most societies around the world have, and the United States has always had, some sort of estate tax. Back in 2001, to give you an idea, here was the estate tax in the United States. The first $600,000, roughly $600,000 worth of whatever you left was exempt. This is a very interesting idea. It says that for the vast majority of people, we have an estate tax, but it doesn't apply to them, because the vast majority of Americans do not have enough property when they die to be worried about a tax that only takes place if you have more than $600,000 or $625,000. So it's, the estate tax really was a bit of a Robin Hood tax, way more than the transaction tax ever was, because it really only goes after the richest amongst us. For example, this year, 2015, the estimate of the government is out of every 1,000 estates, only 1.5 estates out of every 1,000 will be subject to the estate tax. So the overwhelming majority of people, 99%+, will never face the estate tax. And one of the reasons that's the case is that between 2001 and today, the exemption level was raised. So today, a typical couple in the United States, I won't go through the details, can leave the first $11 million of its estate without being subject to tax. Okay? Only the people who leave more than $11 million will be subject to tax, and the estate tax only falls on that part of your estate that's more than $11 million. The first $11 million everybody has is estate tax-free. So what this means is, here in the United States, we don't subject the vast majority of our people to any effective federal estate tax. We don't have a commitment to a level playing field. We ought to. Democracy suggests it. A poll of Americans, whether or not to do that, would be overwhelming in where it would end up if it were done fairly. But we don't have one. And I want to stress that. We could. We once had one that was at least able to tax a significant number of the top 10%, but now we don't. We tax less than half of 1% of the estates, anything at all. Well, then, what do the people pay who have so much money that they leave more than $11,000 as a couple? So they have to pay on that excess above $11 million, of what they leave. Well, the technical rate is 40%. However, there are deductions and exemptions, so the government has given a number of what is the average paid on the amount over $11 million that the super rich leave. The answer, 16%. Okay, what's the bottom line? The super rich are able to leave the bulk of their wealth to their children or to anyone they please. If you want to know why the rich remain rich in the United States, why wealth continues through generation, because we don't use the estate tax that's on the books that we've always had to level the playing field, which was the original intent. We basically allow the vast majority to get through with no estate tax, and the super rich pay only 16%, and that's not going to fundamentally change their position as the super rich with all the powers and privileges that go with that. I wish I could tell you a different story about the estate tax here in the United States, but I can't. That's the truth. Lastly, again, a tax question. I thought I'd group them this time. Here's the question. The states, all 50 of them, and thousands of our cities and towns and some of our counties in America all level their own tax. Those are separate taxes from what the federal government levels. These are taxes that you pay in your state. Sales taxes, property taxes in the community where you live and own a home or a car, income taxes in many states, things like that. And the question is, who pays these taxes? And a recent report covered in a number of newspapers, a report from the, I just want to get it for you here so again I don't misspeak, from the Taxation and Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. They just completed a study. And in 2015, here's what their study shows. The poorest fifth of Americans will pay the following proportion of their income to the state and the city and the county where they live. The poorest fifth will pay 10.9% of their income to take care of the taxes levied by the state, the county, and the city. So what they pay to the federal government is beyond that. Just to the states and the cities, the poorest fifth will pay 10.9%. the middle fifth of our income distribution. The families that are in the middle, they will pay an average 9.4% for their state and local taxes. In other words, the middle pays a lower percentage of its income for state and local taxes compared to the poorest fifth. And now, finally, the richest fifth. The top 1% of our richest people will average paying 5.4% of their income for state and local taxes. The poorest fifth of our people pay 10.9% of their income for their state and local taxes. The middle fifth, 9.4%. The top 1%, 5.4%. Bottom line, simple summary. The richer you are, the lower the percentage of your income that you pay in state and local taxes. That's the reverse of a system called redistribution. When you hear someone tell you about how taxes redistribute from rich to poor, between what I've just reviewed in the estate tax and what I've just reviewed for state and local taxes, the reality is our tax system does nothing to fundamentally alter the inequality. And as that inequality has gotten greater over the last 25 years, the failure of the tax system to do anything about it is what stands out here in the United States. We've reached the midpoint of our program. We're going to take our short break. And when we come back, I will be introducing to you our guest, and we will have a discussion. Please return. It's an exciting discussion about the explosive situation in Greece and its implications for Europe and beyond. We'll be right back.
This year's song's about living behind a grocery store there. And the things they throw away, it is very cheap to live there.
Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and I want to welcome you to and introduce you to our guest today. He is Peter Bratzis, and so first of all, Peter, I want to thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Peter is a professor of political science at the Borough of Manhattan Community College, part of the City University of New York. He is the author of a book, Everyday Life and the State, as well as other volumes that he has worked on. and he's an editor of the journal Situations, Project of the Radical Imagination. He has other things to his credit, but I want to jump into the conversation that we're going to have. Okay, Peter, you're an expert on Greece, and so that's what we want to talk about today. Let's begin by explaining to our audience what is happening. What is this election that's scheduled for the 25th of January? Why is it happening and why is it important?
The elections are on the 25th. There are elections that occurred because the parliament could not elect the president of Greece, and now they have to go. It's, you know, the government has only been in power for about a year and a half. Greece has been going through a very problematic time, as I'm sure most of the listeners know. There has been an austerity program imposed upon Greece that has resulted in the reduction of GDP almost 29% so far. From 2009 to today, GDP has been reduced by about 29%. Unemployment is just over 25% at this point. Youth unemployment is around 60%. And wages have fallen overall about 30%.
Let me just interject for my audience. That's a list of statistics that are worse than the worst moment in the Great Depression in the United States.
That's right.
So for people to get a sense of what Greece is going through, it is worse than the worst period of the 1930s.
That's right.
Go ahead.
And it's worse in other ways, too, I think. I mean, one way that it's worse is that people in the 30s or the 40s or the 60s thought that things would get better. There was some hope. There was some idea of progress, of, you know, there is a time of crisis and the war comes to an end or depression comes to an end and things will change. The political line now is things will not change. The political line now is either one abides by the dictates of the market, does what the market says, otherwise you're finished. And the dilemma for the Greek voters so far has been, do we accept that logic, that the only way to have any semblance of economic prosperity is to be beholden to the global financial markets and do their bidding, or is there another way? So there are two sides in the elections. The leading party at this point is Syriza, which is a coalition of radical left political parties, includes Maoists, includes Trotskyists, Althusserians, mm-hmm. Social Democrats. You know, it's a fairly inclusive coalition that has gone from just under 5% of the vote a few years ago to now they're polling in the mid-30s, about 4-5 to 8% above the second party of the new Democracy, which is a center-right party. They're on the verge of, they will win the elections, and it looks like they will probably have enough also to form a government, although, of course, that's unsure. They can have enough votes to have a government by themselves. They will have a coalition, maybe with some other party. There are various possibilities. The line of Syriza is that austerity has to end. Greek sovereign debt has gone from 113% of GDP in 2009, just before the austerity measures were introduced, to now 175% of GDP.
Let me interrupt, Peter, just to make sure for our audience. Is it correct that the imposition of austerity, laying off hundreds of thousands of public employees, cutting wages, decimating public services, and all the rest that was done in the name that this kind of suffering would be relatively short-term and would solve the problem of this high level of debt?
That's right.
So what you're telling us is the Greek voters are now in a mood that says, we have suffered 5-6 years of this austerity, and the situation has not only not improved and gone away, it's gotten worse. Is that?
Much worse. Okay. Much worse. And the estimate now, and things are so bad that it's estimated about 300,000 households are without electricity within Greece. This is in a country of just over 10 million people in total.
And we've heard also stories, and I was going to ask you about this later, that the younger generation facing unemployment rates like 50-60% are once again, as has happened before in Greek history, leaving the country, desperately looking for jobs elsewhere in Europe, in the United States, and beyond, because the prospects for them as individuals in the Greek economy is as you describe it.
That's right. That's right.
It's a kind of ultimate criticism of a society when its young people, fresh out of an education, leave the country. It means that the country has spent all the money to educate them, and then when they reach their productive potential, they go to some other place which had no cost in training
them.
Give the benefit of their training. It's a double whammy of damage to the Greek economy.
The best educated who leave, the ones who can get a job, who do know English or French or German, who do have university training, who are the ones who leave and can find jobs elsewhere.
Okay, tell us then, if a party that's opposed to austerity wins, one of the first questions I think my listeners will wonder about is, if they know something about Greek history, they know that the Greek Socialist Party got into power some years ago by saying it was against austerity, but when it got in there, it didn't really do that. And they're also aware that France is another country governed currently by a socialist party that came roaring into its dominance by being anti-austerity, and then something happens after they get in. So let me ask you a double question. Is Syriza different? If so, why? And what do you think they will be able to do to really deal with austerity, given what happened to those earlier parties that ran on an anti-austerity platform? Right.
Well, it's not only the case that there are two parties that have governed Greece since democracy was reinstated in 1974. New Democracy, which is a center-right party, and PASOK, which is a center-left socialist party. They have alternated regimes. Both have been in power in the time during the imposition of austerity. Both have supported the austerity. Not only have they accepted the terms that the Europeans have imposed, the troika of the IMF, the ECB, and the European Union, they have gone beyond it. It's not only they have not fought back, but their patrons, the various capitalists in Greece, have used this as an opportunity to impose even further cuts and undoing labor laws than the troika has demanded. So Syriza does not have that background. It is not a political party of the establishment. It is not backed by fractions of the capitalist class. It does not have that constituency to report to.
So in other words, is it fair to say that the crisis brought on by global capitalism has actually been an opportunity for Greek capitalism to strengthen its position at the expense of the rest of Greek society? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. And is that part of what Syriza is saying it's going to stop or it's going to change?
That's one of the top issues, to reinstate the labor laws that have been taken off the books, to increase the minimum wage back to 2009 levels. Now you have many people who work for vouchers or for 300 and 400 euros a month, whereas in 2009 the minimum wage was 751 euros a month. After taxes, it's still not a lot of money, but at least, you know, it's much more than 400.
Wow. Okay, so let's broaden the perspective a little bit. We've been hearing in the recent newspapers, or at least I keep seeing it, statements by a variety of European leaders, particularly from Germany, but not only from Germany, basically saying that a victory by Syriza is unthinkable, is outrageous, is unbearable, that it will have devastating consequences, it will collapse the economy of Greece even further, it will lead to the ejection of Greece from the European community, etc. Tell me, what is exercise? What's at stake for the rest of Europe in this little country in the corner of Europe's upcoming election that makes it so much the focus? And how are the Greek people reacting to this enormous, and there's no polite word for this, interference in Greek politics by the rest of Europe.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the interesting and the unusual dimensions of these elections, how invested other foreign leaders are in the Greek elections. Germans, not only Germans, saying directly, do not vote for Syriza, do not support them. You know, it will not be good for the Greek people. And there's a lot at stake, obviously. To begin with, it's not only Greece that has economic problems. All of the periphery of Europe has economic problems. Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland.
Eastern
European countries, of course, you know, and even further to the north. France has significant economic problems itself.
Right.
Britain also, right. in many ways. Greece is probably, you know, the worst case scenario at this point in time. But there are a number of issues at stake. One is what a successful movement in Greece to reject austerity politics and demand a different kind of political response to the economic crisis, how that may spread to these other countries.
Right.
So a success in Greece, if it spreads then to Spain and Podemos, which is a Spanish equivalent in many ways of Syriza, is doing very well in the polls. They are well positioned for the next elections in Spain, whenever they may occur. Sinn Féin, Ireland, is doing very well, and there are Irish elections coming up very soon. There is one fear that a Greek success would spread throughout Europe,
giving the other European movements the feeling that they can also win power, and that they could then maybe even help each other, because all of them have a comparable problem, and they're negotiating with the IMF or the Germans, becomes a different story if they're allied together.
That's right. That is the case. It's also true that there is no way Greece can ever pay back the debt. I mean, the projections until 2020 is that Greece has to pay back $90 billion in the next 5 years. That's impossible. It's not going to happen. Now, the question is, how far down the road do you kick the can? How far down the road do you defer what is going to be inevitably a crisis? And the Greek situation is only the tip of the iceberg, because the Greeks owe somewhere in the neighborhood of $300+ billion. Italy and Spain only put together owe more than $3.5 trillion in debt. Trillion, which I think the economists, you know, consider, even the economists consider that a lot of money.
Yes, it is.
So €3.5 trillion is a lot of sovereign debt. If Greece were to default, that could be the end of the euro, and that could be the beginning of a very, very big economic crisis in Europe, because there's no way the Germans or the European Central Bank or the IMF could easily cover a run on Italian or Spanish sovereign debt. They can cover the Greek sovereign debt, just barely. But to cover those amounts are, at this point at least, unthinkable. So there's a lot of stake potentially. And how the default happens, which is inevitable. Does it happen quickly? Is it managed and it happens in a way that it does not scare the market too much? All these things are really up in arms, you know,
so
up in
the air. That's why there's so much interest in and interference in the Greeks, because of the fear of this kind of contagion, if you like.
There is. But not everyone is afraid. I mean, you had, for example, the Financial Times recently say Syriza is an party of extremists, whatever that may mean, but they're the only hope. They're the last hope. Because they realize, and the Financial Times is not a Marxist newspaper, the last time I checked, the Financial Times realizes that an unplanned and unregulated way of defaulting on the loans is much, much worse and more dangerous than a haircut and extending the loan payments into the future and managing what is inevitable in a way that does not spook the markets unnecessarily.
It would be an interesting replay of a historic phenomena that is worth mentioning. When Franklin Roosevelt, in the depths of the Depression, put through huge taxes on corporations and the rich in order to pay for Social Security and unemployment compensation and the first minimum wage this country had, the right-wing community predicted gloom and doom and the collapse of the civilization and everything else, And the answer Roosevelt's people gave is a little bit like the Financial Times. The people who don't want this to happen have no solution to the problem.
Right.
Roosevelt at least has a solution, and even if it's a bit painful for the people at the top, they still hold on to their bulk of their wealth. They still hold on to controlling the corporations, but we have at least some kind of plan that gets through. On the one hand, that's in a sense what the Financial Times is saying about Syriza, but then the minute you say it, you then raise the question, is that what Syriza wants to do? We said about Roosevelt, he saved capitalism from itself.
Yes.
Will Syriza save capitalism from itself?
It might. It might not. You know, and there are other options, too.
That's because, and you did answer it earlier, because it's a coalition, and it has all kinds of perspectives on that question inside itself.
Well, it's a coalition of anti-capitalist, of Marxist and allied movements that have as a goal the transformation of Greece to a new kind of a society. You know, not a non-capitalist society. Right. Now, we also know from some of the older generation of the Greeks, like Aristotle, that for the possibility of politics, you have to presuppose the household. People have to have food to eat and shelter. If they don't have that, the conditions for politics are not there, because people are overwhelmingly concerned with satisfying their immediate needs and don't have the luxury of contemplating what would a good society look like, how should we organize ourselves, how should we live. So Syriza recognizes that to do a concrete analysis of the political situation in Greece, and not only in Greece, first, you have to take care of the immediate pressing issues. And then there can be work on transforming society in ways that make it much more just and democratic and equitable.
Okay, in the little bit of time we have left, let me ask you a question that I know is on the minds of our listeners. Greece, as you put it, is the worst-case scenario of what austerity has done. And one of the results has been the collapse of the middle of Greek politics,
right,
the decline of PASOK, the decline of New Democracy, the rise of Syriza. But the interesting thing is the bulk of the new political thrust is to the left in Syriza.
Yes.
But there's also another one to the right, which is typical. In this case, the Golden Dawn, anti-immigrant and so on party. Tell us a little bit about how you would explain that the left has done significantly better emerging as an alternative to the middle than the right has in Greece.
Well, the right has done pretty well in Greece too, relatively speaking, because what is in effect a Nazi party in Greece, the Golden Dawn, has gone from below 1%, from 0.0-something% in elections, to now probably will get somewhere around 6% of the vote. So they've done well also. And, you know, there are two responses to the crisis. One response is that things are not fundamentally wrong. What has happened is something has come up and screwed up the system. There's been a corruption of the system. So according to the fascists, it's the immigrants who have come in, or the political refugees who are coming in. They have destroyed Greek society. They are at fault. To say that the Greek system itself is flawed, that the Greek political establishment played an active role in destroying the country, is pretty traumatic. You know, for people who grew up being patriotic,
right,
and believing in the country, it's a traumatic step to go from that to saying we were wrong all along,
right,
we were sold a bunch of lies, the system is fundamentally flawed. We see it here with the Tea Party too,
right.
I mean, there are other analogies. And the only democratic response so far in all of Europe to the crisis of austerity has been Syriza in Greece and Podemos in Spain. Because if you look to Britain, for example, it's UKIP,
yes,
that seems to
right,
benefit from the crisis. The same in France, you know,
with
by and large.
National Front.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, last question that we'll have time for, a quick answer. If Syriza wins, what then?
Then we have a big fight. Then is the struggle. And because there will be a lot of pressure put upon Greece to capitulate, a lot of pressure to take whatever minimal deal the Troika is willing to offer up, and to fall back in line and to make an example out of Greece to the rest of Europe that you cannot choose your own way. It's either our way or we'll make you into a North Korea and cut you off from the global financial markets.
It's an amazing moment in European history and in Greek history. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, Rick.
For sharing your insights. Before we close off, I want to remind you of two things. A, once again, the websites that we maintain, free of charge, open 24/7, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. I want to direct your attention also to truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day that carries this program and also a great deal of other useful information. And finally, I want to ask you all to become partners in this program. If there's parts of it that you like, let others know. Use your Facebook, your Twitter, your other social media to share the insights and to make this program even more effective than we try to make it on all the radio stations, now numbering over 40, that carry this program. If you can donate to those stations to help them, please consider doing it. If you can also donate to us, we will be grateful. And finally, I am available, as I have said before, to travel around the United States. I do a great deal of that to support radio stations that carry this program, but also to bring the message that we develop on this program to as many audiences as we can. I appreciate your interest. I appreciate your listening and viewing, and I look forward to being with you again next week.
Gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.